So here we are at our last session. All good things have to come to an end. But we have one last session, which I think is going to be great. Yes, it is. It's on prisoners and public interpreting. Prisoners and public interpreting captivity at historic sites. And so we have Christopher Barr, who is a park ranger with the National Park Service at Chickamauga and Chattanooga National Military Park, and also grew up close in Anderson Prison, has a long history of, his family has a long history with Andersonville. He has, in fact, written extensively on Andersonville, and he has a book under contract with the intriguing title of To Lay My Bones in Old Georgia, Andersonville Prison, 1864 to 1865. And he and actually all of the participants on this panel have articles published in the latest issue of Civil War History on Civil War prisons. I don't know how many of you subscribe to that journal, but when I got that journal and I looked at the cover and it was about Civil War prisons, I thought, aren't we timely here? And if I had opened up the cover and I had noticed, I would realize that not only are we timely, we have all of the people who contributed to that issue of the journal sitting right here. Although I will say they're giving other papers, but I think this speaks to academic community. They all know each other. They love working together. They decided to, you know, revisit and come again. Right, people? Yes, absolutely. So there we go. So we have Christopher Barr. We have sitting next to him Angela Zombeck, who is an assistant professor in the Department of Social and Behavioral Sciences at St. Petersburg College in Clearwater, Florida. She has a book under contract with Kent State entitled Penitentiaries, Punishment, and Military Prisons, Familiar Responses to an Extraordinary Crisis During the American Civil War. Her article in the special issue of Civil War History is entitled Paternalism and Imprisonment at Castle Thunder, Reinforcing Gender Norms in the Confederate Capital. Her paper today is Key West Civil War Prisoners, Few in Number and Overlooked in Narrative. And finally, we have Adam Dombey, who is an assistant professor of history at the College of Charleston. He is currently completing a book manuscript with a working title of The False Cause, Fraud, Fabrication, and White Supremacy in Confederate Memory. And he, too, along with his fellow panelists, has a recently published article in Civil War History, and his article is entitled Captives of Memory, The Contested Legacy of Race and Atrocity at Andersonville National Historic Site. His paper today is entitled Prisoners Under Glass, Nationalism, Forgetting, and the Public History, and Public History at the National Prisoner of War Museum. So
that adjusted for you, everybody. How's everybody doing this afternoon? Excellent, excellent. Well, first off, I just want to say thank you, Lorian and Daniel and everybody for putting this together. I've really been looking forward to this for a long time, and I knew it was a good omen when Thursday night our Lyft driver on the way back from dinner, it turns out, was the son of a prisoner who had been held at Cabanatuan in the Philippines. So we started it off on the right foot. So it was a good omen, and I think it's played out nicely here. So just a really quick little bit about myself. As Dr. White's mentioned, I grew up in Sumter County, Georgia, which is home to Andersonville Prison. So I wasn't quite born in the prison, but I feel like I grew up there sometimes. I mean, that was my backyard park a little bit. My Cub Scout leader growing up was a man named Fred Boyles, who was the superintendent throughout most of the 1980s and 90s. And you're going to hear a lot about Mr. Boyles from Adam when he comes up in just a minute. And so it kind of seemed natural that I would begin to work there as a park ranger. I worked there off and on from the summer of 2010, 2011, until November of 2014, when on a cold November night, during one of our evening programs, during the 150th anniversary of the Civil War, we were doing a 150th anniversary of the prison, we were doing a program on kind of escapees. And so Lorian was actually there. And so while she was giving her program, I quietly escaped and went to Chickamauga. And as I found, you can never actually escape Andersonville. But I'm not actually here to talk about Andersonville. If you want to learn and really get into some of the public stuff with that, the staff there is absolutely stellar. Jennifer Hopkins is an amazing park ranger who's there. I know that, Beth, I think you've worked with her a little bit too. She's amazing and is your absolute go-to resource on that. I'm not actually here to talk about prison camps at all. We do actually a pretty good job of that kind of out there. I mean, we've been hearing papers and presentations on individual camps and experiences of people held in camps. And even when we talk about preserving camps, we actually do a really good job of that, believe it or not. As Mike Gray has been involved with, they've recently reconstructed some original structures. Just one up at Elmira. At Andersonville National Historic Site is, of course, very famous. Believe it or not, in the National Park Service, there are 12 military prison sites of the American Civil War that are preserved. A lot of people are surprised about that one. My favorite is, and I know it's weird to have a favorite, but we are all kindred spirit here. We all have a weird favorite. My favorite is Fort Wood, which is part of the National Park Service, although it's not named that anymore. Fort Wood was located on Bedloe's Island in the New York Harbor. And then that island was later renamed Liberty Island. They filled in Fort Wood and built the Statue of Liberty on top of it. So when you're at the Statue of Liberty, you are standing on top of a place where Confederates were denied liberty, and some of them died in captivity there. So again, we preserve a lot of prison camps around the country, and we actually do a pretty good job of it. But if a lot of you guys in this room are familiar with the work of the historian Robert Doyle, I know he was referenced yesterday, I believe, and he kind of talks about this narrative of captivity, kind of from the point of capture all the way up through your release and lament. And one of the things that we are kind of missing from our public history is kind of that point of capture, which is a little bit unfortunate because also in the National Park Service, we preserve over 100 battlefields. Now, some of them are small battlefield sites that are, out in a big national park out west where some Indian War conflicts were taking place. Some of them are really small that, you've probably never heard of. The Battle of Bloody Marsh in St. Simon's Island, Georgia, is part of the War of Jenkins' Ear, which the only reason I mentioned that is just so that I could say the name, the War of Jenkins' Ear. That's a great name. That's a battlefield site. But we preserve a lot of battlefields, but we don't necessarily do a very good job of talking about captivity on the battlefields. And so what I'm going to be doing today isn't necessarily sharing with you any original research. We've been hearing some great original research on that. These guys are doing some amazing stuff out there. What I'm going to be doing is kind of just a really quick report from the field a little bit. How are we doing in our battlefields, and what can we do better, and how can we do that? And so, if you'll forgive my technology here, trying to save some paper, I didn't print. So what I want to do is profile a few national park sites that are home to battlefields and talk a little bit about their prisoner of war story a little bit, and then how do they do it. So the first one we'll talk about is Boston National Historical Park. So, Rev War, woo, he's excited. All right. Don't want to do just Civil War here. So Boston National Historical Park is a really unique park. If you've never been there, it's not just this big park. It's a complex assortment of structures and places that are kind of all over the city. It's kind of most famous for the Freedom Trail. They've got Faneuil Hall that's there. They have a World War II destroyer, the USS Cassin Young. But they also have the Bunker Hill Monument, so the Battle of Bunker Hill, one of the first kind of major, I guess I'm not a Rev War guy, so nobody throw anything at me for calling Bunker Hill a major battle or not. But they do have the Bunker Hill battlefield. And there's not a large number of men that were taken prisoner there, like 25 or 30. But they did kind of spark a little bit of a political crisis because it forced the British government to kind of wrestle with this question of, are we going to recognize the legitimacy of the colonists? Because if you do that, you have to treat these guys as prisoners of war. If you treat these as insurrectionists, traitors, rebels, you get to just throw them in jail. And so these guys kind of they end up floating around. They end up in Halifax, up in Nova Scotia, and they really do kind of have this interesting story to them. And I'm not necessarily here to talk about their story. What I'm here to talk about is, how does Boston National Historical Park deal with it? And the answer is, so this is going to be really short, they don't. And I say this with love. I'm friends with several of the Rangers that are up there. And so, again, these guys do not appear in any of their museum exhibits. They don't really appear in any of their tours, with one exception. They have one Ranger, and so I'm going to give her a little bit of a shout out here. Her name is Jocelyn Gould, who has a little bit of an interest in this. And so on kind of her regular Bunker Hill monument tours, you know, when she's talking about this thing as being a monument to liberty, she kind of juxtaposes that a little bit and talks about people that lose their liberty. That's the extent of Boston National Historical Park's interpretation. So the question then kind of becomes, well, why? And so I asked Jocelyn this. I said, Jocelyn, why don't you guys have more? I mean, this seems like this should be a big story for you all. And what she told me is that it's for a variety of reasons. Some of it is it's just, you know, a lack of interest. I mean, this isn't everybody's favorite topic in the world. It's not as romantic and sexy as charges and all this kind of stuff. Eh, this guy's getting taken prisoner and sent to Canada. Yeah. I like Canada as much as the next person. No offense to my War of 1812 friends here today. Part of it is also just a simple kind of lack of knowledge in some cases. There's not a lot out there on these guys. There's really not. It's not a topic that people have really dug in on. So when a ranger starts working there and saying, well, I want to learn about prisoners, there's not that go-to book they can go read. There's not that go-to pamphlet or journal or anything like that, not even an article, really. And a big part of their problem is also that they have such a wide story. To be a park ranger at Boston National Historical Park, you have to be ready when a visitor walks in the door to be able to talk about the Battle of Bunker Hill. You also have to be ready to talk about kamikaze attacks in World War II, because the USS Cassin Young was attacked several times. They have to be able to talk about Rosie the Riveters, who work in the Charlestown Navy Yard. They have to be able to talk about the Stamp Act. I mean, they have this huge just array of things you have to be relatively well-versed on. And so kind of fitting in one more topic, it's a little problematic for them. And so we'll kind of come back to them in just a few minutes. The next park I want to talk to you guys about is one, this is, I probably should do like Paul Springer did and give the disclaimer here. What I'm saying is not reflective of the opinions or views of the National Park Service or the United States government. The next park I want to talk a little bit about is my own, Chickamauga and Chattanooga National Military Park. I'm going to be really polite here and say that we're trying. We're trying. Prisoners at Chickamauga and Chattanooga National Military Park, particularly at the Battle of Chickamauga in September of 1863, should be a huge story. I know you had I should have stolen your PowerPoint with the numbers up there. Those huge spikes in numbers of prisoners that we saw on the PowerPoint earlier, that all happens in the fall of 1863. The Battle of Chickamauga, September 18th to the 20th of that year, is the first major battle of the American Civil War after the breakdown in the prisoner exchange. Some of the Gettysburg guys get caught up and are held long term, but this is Chickamauga is the first big one that happens after this breakdown. So, in a sense, I mean, Chickamauga kind of leads to Andersonville in a way. What ends up happening is the Richmond prison complex is pretty small. There's not a lot of prisoners that are being held there that summer. Then all the Chickamauga guys get captured. They all go into Richmond. Richmond gets overcrowded. The Richmond officials start looking at each other and going, we need a new prison. Anybody got any solutions? And somebody says, Southwest Georgia. I mean, so without Chickamauga, there kind of is no Andersonville. This should be a huge part of our story, but it's not. In fact, prisoners of war make exactly, and I walked through the exhibits quite detailed over the last couple of years, make exactly one appearance in our exhibits. If you're familiar with the Chickamauga Battlefield Visitor Center, in kind of the room to the left when you first walk in, it's kind of set up like a timeline of the Civil War. And it has, and it just has a timeline entry that says, February 14th, 1864, Andersonville Prison opened. And befitting of the fact that we don't seem to do a good job of talking about prisoners in the battlefields, that's actually the wrong date, which is kind of fascinating. Yeah, I know. Now everybody's like, oh, man, this guy can't go back home, can he? I don't know. We'll see. However, one of the things that we've been doing there is trying to incorporate it into some of our public programs a little bit. Since 2011, the park has had two, we call kind of special tours, special programs that are about prisoners of war. One was done about 2011 or so, and then I did the other one last summer. And these are relatively small attended, 20 visitors. You kind of do a tour of the battlefield, sharing accounts of guys who are captured on the battlefield and kind of what happens to them as they're leaving the field. And so we did that. The other thing that we also do a lot of is just front desk informal conversation. It is not at all uncommon for a visitor to walk into the front desk and say, "Hey, my ancestor was with the 21st Ohio Infantry and was captured here. Then he went to Andersonville. We're on our way to Andersonville, but can you help me out? I want to understand where he's, what happened to him." Now, the staff at Chickamauga has figured out by now that as soon as somebody says the magic word capture, they immediately come grab me. But that's a lot of what we end up doing. But again, that's nothing formal. That's nothing codified. That's nothing in our long-range interpretive plans or foundation documents or anything like that. But we are kind of trying a little bit. Now, kind of not surprisingly, the ability of a battlefield park to incorporate the prisoner of war story or kind of these extra things a little bit is pretty related to its staff size and funding level. And so what I want to do for just a second is talk about another Revolutionary War park or series of parks. The Southern Campaign Group of the National Park Service, kind of jumping time periods here to keep everybody awake. The Southern Campaign Group consists of Cowpens Battlefield, Overmountain Trail, Overmountain Victory National Historical Trail, and a few other kind of associated sites. And I asked their acting chief or their chief of interpretation, who's a friend of mine named Vanessa Smiley, and I asked her. I said, "Well, what do you guys do with prisons? Is it in your exhibits?" "No, it's not." I said, "Okay, well, do you guys do anything with it?" And her response was, "Well, occasionally visitors will ask what happened to the prisoners from Cowpens, and we tell them, well, they go north up towards Guilford." All right. Well, that's something. It's better than nothing, but it's something. And so you start thinking about, well, why don't they do more? Well, this is a tiny park. I mean, this is a park that has a staff that's so small that if one person goes out sick with the flu, I mean, you start having to discuss, okay, are we closing the park today? Being able to say, well, let's dig in and go research this topic that's not necessarily out there, that's a little problematic. It really is. And kind of take the opposite track from that, perhaps our most prominent or famous National Park Service battlefield, the big elephant in the room, the tiny little crossroads battle of no important consequence whatsoever, in Pennsylvania, Gettysburg. All of us Chickamauga people, rivalry between parks, right? So Gettysburg National Military Park is perhaps kind of the opposite of Cowpens and the Southern Victory or the Southern Campaign Group. They have a tremendous staff. They have something like 7.5 times the staff of what Cowpens does, 3 or 4 times the visitation of what they do. They also have this bevy of there's Gettysburg College up there. I mean, the Pahanka intern program. They have the licensed battlefield guides. They have all this stuff that's out there that allows them to be able to support visitors coming in and wanting kind of basic information to keep the doors open. And so that frees up some of their staff to actually be able to do some prison stuff. So I want to share with you guys a few things that Gettysburg has done. It's kind of an example of maybe one park that we can maybe try to go off of. And what Gettysburg has done is they actually have out in the battlefield a few wayside exhibits that deal with prisoners. Most notably being the one that's over, we've all seen the famous photo of the 3 Confederate prisoners taken at Gettysburg. I have no idea how we've made it through this conference without that picture being on the screen. But we, most of us have seen that picture, and they've got a wayside out there that kind of says, oh, here's where that was taken. Here's how those guys, here's what happened to them. This past summer, as part of their regular ranger tours, they were doing an evening hike of McPherson's Ridge that was talking about the aftermath of battle. And one of the topics that they list on their kind of calendar of events is, you know, caring for the wounded and the prisoners. So they're building in some prisoner narrative into their regular programming. In their exhibits, they also try to touch a little bit on the prisoner exchange cartel as it existed in the summer of 1863 and trying to shape that, how it would affect guys taken prisoner there. Interestingly enough, one of the other things that Gettysburg does to interpret the prisoner of war experience on the battlefield it has nothing to do with the Civil War. Like many of our nation's national military parks, there were prisoner of war camps in the park during World War II. And so occasionally they'll do World War II POW programs. They actually did last year a thing with a living history program with German prisoners of war that were doing like landscape restoration, out clearing brush with a bunch of guys in like POW uniforms and park rangers in like 1940s era uniforms, which was, I think, really interesting. They posted video of that on their park Facebook page. So if you really want to see that, you can check that out. And so when we think about these battlefields and how are we doing and what aren't we doing, kind of the few recurring themes that always kind of seem to drive this are the idea that so much of this is driven, at least what we're doing or not doing, is driven by kind of a single person. So, for example, right now at Chickamauga, I'm kind of the prison guy. My predecessor, the park ranger, was in the position that I'm in. Interestingly enough, he had also come from Andersonville, so he was kind of a prison guy. If I leave next week and go to a different park, kind of our prisons, our interpretation of captivity is going to fall apart. If Jocelyn Gould moves from Boston, goes to another park, they kind of stop. So how can we fix this? What can we do about this? What are some things that we can do to improve this? Well, one of the things that we can do is just improve our websites. And I know this sounds really kind of simplistic, but for most of the time when you, in the Park Service, when you go to work at a new park, you're going to go to the park website and read on every National Park Service website that has a section called History and Culture. And it's got some of your famous stories. It shouldn't take us too much to sit down and write up a short article, 3 or 4 paragraphs maximum, about prisoners. And to illustrate a great example of a battlefield park that is doing this, the National Park Service actually has a World War II battlefield near Dutch Harbor, Alaska. And there's only a few prisoners that get taken there. Like, it's like less than 10. But that park profile, they have a series of like 5 or 6 veterans of the battle that they've done oral histories with. And one of the guys that they've done an oral history with that they put on their website for you to learn about their site is one of these prisoners. And he talks about the process of being captured and where you taken. It's really fascinating, but it kind of ingrains that into their narrative. That's something that I can do at Chickamauga that I haven't done yet. That's something that Jocelyn could do at Boston. That's something that somebody could do at Cowpens, because a large number of British soldiers captured there. And that's something that we can do to try to create a little bit more of a lasting thing. So when that next ranger comes in, they at least have a resource to get started. And the other thing that we need is one of the reasons why I'm super excited to be here is you guys. Believe it or not, the way most park rangers build our public programs is by reading your work, the professional academics, the professional historians that are out there. So when Mike Gray's book comes out, you know, there's going to be people that can read that and go, oh, wow, what are ways I can incorporate and interpret captivity? When your book came out, I know that the staff at Congaree National Park all bought copies of it so they could read it to be able to talk about the prisoners who are hiding in the swamps outside of Columbia, South Carolina. There you go. So the work that you guys are doing is important for us to be able to do our work. No, the general public is probably not going to necessarily read everybody in this room's dissertation. I know, shocking. I'm sorry to disappoint everyone. That's the most depressing thing anybody said in this whole conference, right? We're talking about people dying. Mike talked about feces before lunch. I just said the most disappointing sentence. But here's the thing. We do. We love to find y'all's dissertations. We love your books when you publish them. And inevitably, the stuff that you guys are writing about are the things that we take out to the public. And so please keep doing what you're doing, because it helps us do our job. And so that's kind of what I want to end with, is just a big thank you to all of you guys for doing what you do, so that we can do what we do here in our national battlefield park. So thank you guys, and I'm going to turn it over to Angela. I promised her, I'm a Georgia fan and she's a Florida fan, and they play at 3:30. I promised her I would not talk trash.
Good job. It's implicit, right? I just have to say, if I start shaking, it's because I'm freezing. I'm kind of embarrassed to say that. I grew up in Cleveland, but I've lived in Florida for the past 11 years, and blood thinning is a real thing, so we're going to try and get through this. First of all, I just want to start by thanking the organizers. Thank you, Lorian and Daniel and Leanne, for the opportunity to be here. I've really enjoyed this. And today I'm going to talk about something that people don't think about that much, and that is Civil War prisoners in Florida. So usually when I give a talk about the Civil War era in Florida, I like to poll the audience, so if you would humor me. How many of you have been to Florida's beaches? Show of hands, okay. How many of you have been to Key West? How many of you, while you were there on the beach, either at Key West or elsewhere, have thought a lot about the Civil War I or Civil War prisoners? Okay, see, I figured that when I give this talk publicly in Florida, or I give talks on Florida in Florida, it's the general public, they're kind of looking at me like I'm a little bit weird. I thought I might get a better return, so that's good. Well, what I want to talk today about is the prisoners of war at Fort Taylor. And this is, if I can get my, whoops, no, I broke it. There we go. Laser is somewhere. Well, that's Fort Taylor right there on the end, if I can get the laser to work. Nope, I can't.
Mike,
I know. Now I'm following the footsteps of Mike Gray here and not being able to actually use this.
Hang on, stop pushing buttons.
I love it.
Just keep pushing. You'll come back.
Where's the pictures?
Okay.
We
and
need...
The laser pointer is right there in the
center. In the center. There we go. So this is Fort Taylor here. During the 19th century, this was actually not connected to Key West. This was kind of the outermost guard there. So as you can see here in the picture, this fort occupied the southwest tip of Key West. And right now, I mean, Key West itself and in Fort Taylor State Park is actually one of the most sought-after attractions in the state of Florida. It draws domestic tourists. It draws a whole bunch of international tourists. And most people go there to go to the beach. So it's really kind of hard for history to compete with sitting on a beach in Florida. But the other thing that is interesting about Fort Taylor itself is that it now boasts the largest collection of Civil War era artillery in the United States. And that is due, as I'll talk about in a couple of minutes, largely to the efforts of local resident Howard England, who undertook a massive excavation project. But the thing about Fort Taylor is that when tourists go there, they're drawn to the big guns. And they're certainly impressive, but they take away from the broader significance of the fort itself. This was called by contemporaries the Gibraltar of the Gulf, and it was seen in the era of empire as something that was very important to protecting U.S. shipping interests in the Atlantic, in the Gulf, and in the Caribbean from competing foreign powers. During the Civil War, Fort Taylor and Key West were really important, although not that much talked about, because of the fact that the East Gulf Blockading Squadron was headquartered there. So if Key West gets any kind of a nod in scholarship, it's probably towards that. But Fort Taylor, in addition to being a fort, also functioned as a prison, although it's not in the official records at all as such. So the types of people that it detained were blockade runners, for sure, but also secessionist sympathizers who might have been living in Key West, those who violated the dictates of martial law that the U.S. government imposed there, and also disobedient U.S. soldiers. And so basically none of that appears in the interpretive history at the fort itself. But if we look at that, the story of Fort Taylor and its prisoners illustrates how the Civil War really reached the farthest possessions of U.S. territory. It divided the high seas, it divided Key West itself. And the other thing that the interpretive signage, some of which we'll look at today at Fort Taylor, indicates is the role of state parks in interpreting, one, just general history, and two, more specifically in this case, the history of imprisonment at the fort. So, which slides? A little bit of background on the site itself. Like I mentioned before, in 1968, Howard England, who was a local Key West resident, he was also an architect and engineer for the Navy's Public Works Department. He began excavating Civil War era artillery. And the excavation went on for just about 8 years. It was England himself and a crew of volunteers. And they unearthed basically all of the artillery pieces that are on display at the fort. Once this started happening, I mean, Fort Taylor was an active fortification from 1861 until 1947. And then after that point, when it was deactivated, it became a naval junkyard. So all of this excavation is going on at that point. And there was an effort by England and local Key West residents to push for, one, Fort Taylor to be designated a National Historic Site, which happened. England then became the unofficial curator. And then it got National Landmark status in 1973, while it was still a naval junkyard. In the 1970s, those efforts to get recognition for Fort Taylor continued, and there was a proposal that passed Congress. It reached President Ford's desk in 1975 to make Fort Taylor part of the National Park System. But because of budgetary reasons in the 1970s, given the terrible economy, President Ford turned that down. And so in light of that, the efforts to push for Fort Taylor's national significance went to let's transfer the fort itself from naval possession to the state of Florida. And so that eventually happened on October 15th, 1976. And then the work that England had done was kind of piggybacked on. There were other actual, like Civil War era and Spanish-American War era artifacts that were at Fort Taylor. Those got moved to Tallahassee because, as you're aware, hurricanes frequently hit Florida, and they didn't want those things to be damaged. So really, the only thing that remains at the fort are the cannons and some interpretive signs. But the interpretive signs were really kind of late in coming. The first one appeared on August 16, 2014, and that marker was to basically commemorate the work that Howard England had done to excavate the cannons. And then after that marker went up, Howard England's son Edward worked with state park officials to create a broader series of interpretive signage, which just went up a couple of years ago. So the problem of Florida, I think, is really kind of illustrated here. We have this, and how does it compete with this? I mean, not to analyze or overanalyze my vacation photos, but this is such an interesting picture because here's a tourist, here's a cruise ship, and she's kind of looking at the cruise ship. Like, I'm gonna bypass the fort because what went on here might not be interesting as what they're doing. So, and that kind of, I think, speaks to the problem of Florida history in general, which is a whole other subject that we could talk about, but more specifically to Fort Taylor in Key West. So recently, Tracy Revels has noted that over 50,000 books have been written on the Civil War, but Florida, and really Key West and Fort Taylor itself, are generally fortunate to rate even just a footnote. So very few people, I would say, just judging from our poll before, and this is kind of a biased group, so I got a better response, spend a lot of time pondering Florida's Civil War era history, and I think even fewer think about what really went on inside this fort. During the Civil War, even though Florida seceded from the Union, U.S. authorities never left Key West, and they imposed martial law on the island on May 10, 1861. But in the interpretive program that's here, that narrative and the importance of the fort beyond guarding the waters is really overlooked in favor of the cannons. And there's one interpretive marker that we'll look at here next that deals with imprisonment. But in order to get people's attention, I mean, you've got people who are rushing to the beach, right? So if they're going to go through the fort, they're going through it quickly. So on the interpretive sign that's located where prisoners were held in Fort Taylor, it says a little bit about, well, let's go there. It's on this one. I don't know how well you can make this out, but it tells you a little bit about the jail cells. And down here is what I'm pointing to. It says here, soldiers, sailors, and blockade runners were often held in the fort until they could be tried for their charges. But here's the kicker. In July 1865, Dr. Samuel Mudd and other conspirators of President Abraham Lincoln were held there for a short time before being transferred to Fort Jefferson, the Dry Tortugas. And I can tell you after researching this, I do a lot of newspaper research, and I found nothing. There was a regular Key West correspondent for about every major newspaper stationed at Key West writing reports out. I found absolutely nothing about Mudd being there. So again, it's how do you appeal to the tourists who are really kind of passing through. So the question then is, what's the broader story behind the fort? Now, as people at the park tell it, through the signage, they talk about how the fort never fired a shot. That's one of the things that the interpretive signs say right up front. And it's one of the things that if you go through, like, the East Martello Museum, which kind of chronicles the history of Key West, is something that they're very proud about. So it's kind of ironic to me that in the interpretive events that happen at Fort Taylor, there's one event Living History Weekends, which I believe happens on the third Saturday of every month, where there's reenactors that come in, and the only Civil War soldiers that were actively patrolling Key West were Union. But they have Confederates set up camp, and they clean their weapons, they fire their weapons, they work in the blacksmith shop at Fort Taylor, and they basically kind of have a Civil War encampment. The other thing that I find more entertaining is Fort Taylor was pretty well fortified. And every February, and I can understand the draw because the reenactors that come from New England, they come from various places in the North, and February in the North is cold. So what better place to go than Key West, okay? But the major event they have, the capstone of that weekend in February, is a land-sea battle between schooners at sea and artillery on the shore at Fort Taylor. Despite the fact that during the Civil War, a contemporary said, this was never going to happen. I can give you an example here. One of the correspondents from the New York Express in January 1861 wrote from Key West that Fort Taylor consisted of the heaviest Columbiads and howitzers in our service, and they trusted that its commanding officers would have no occasion to try their strength since assailants would have to sacrifice hundreds of lives and millions of dollars to breach the fort's only vulnerable point, which was the land side. And then this is quoting the newspaper man. It would be madness for any but a well-organized, well-disciplined expedition supported by a strong naval force to attempt its capture. So contemporaries acknowledged that assaulting Fort Taylor wasn't likely. Howard England himself, when he was going through the excavation, acknowledged it's not likely. But I think what this tells us is kind of a little bit about how the Civil War is remembered. In Civil War memory studies, it's often easier to talk about the experience of war, and in this case, a land-sea battle that never happened, than to deal with the contentious issues of imprisonment and the other causes of the war. Going forward here, oops, I think I actually skipped one. Did I? Maybe I didn't. There we go. That's the one I want. I'm going to skip around a little bit here. We talked a little bit about guards. We mentioned them the other day. Guarding a fort, I would contend, is just slightly more exciting than being held in it. Because you have, I mean, if you think about this now, this is something that I say to my students when I'm teaching, like, people want to go to Key West now. Back then, sure, it was a thriving city. It's kind of a unique frontier region because it drew people from the north. They could get involved in wrecking. They could get involved in later on sponge diving. They could make a pretty good living. But it's still out in a tropical climate in the 19th century where you don't have air conditioning and you're subject to plagues like typhoid and yellow fever. So the guards that are patrolling the fort really have some strict rules that they need to abide by, and they're encouraged to do some of the things like participate in religious activities that prisoners would have been encouraged to do too. The men who came into the fort when Key West was put under martial law at that time were under the command of Captain John Brannan. So he saw when Florida seceded from the Union, Brannan was waiting directives from Washington on whether or not he should actually move to the fort and try and hold the island. And communications between Key West and Washington were pretty much non-existent. So Brannan made an executive decision and decided on January 14, 1861, that he and troops of Battery B, 1st U.S. Artillery, moved quietly in the middle of a Saturday night. They moved from one end of Key West across the island into Fort Taylor, and the civilians wake up that Sunday morning the next day, and they find themselves under martial law. So that was quite a shock to them. When martial law was declared, Major French issued the order, and here's some things that were restricted on Key West. Confederate flags were ordered down from shop windows and verandas. He removed and disbanded the pro-Confederate militia called the Island Guards. He banned all liquor sales on the island. He ordered all adult men who planned to stay on the island to swear an oath of allegiance to the Union. And he organized 200 men into two Union volunteer companies, which was really kind of a symbolic display since nobody really expected the island to be besieged. So these men were responsible for maintaining order on Key West, and they oversaw a different type of imprisonment during the Civil War than what's usually talked about, and that's imprisonment on the small scale. So I can give you some images here of what imprisonment, if you were at Fort Taylor held there, these are your quarters, okay? So this, what we're seeing here is Sallyport. If you're going through and taking a guided tour of Fort Taylor, this is stop four, so it has the interpretive marker that we looked at before. And basically, this would have been the entrance. There was a drawbridge that would have linked Fort Taylor to the island of Key West. If you were a prisoner, you were going to come across, come in here, and this is as far as you get. So there's cells like this on either side here and here, and most of the time, that door is closed. So the gentlemen that were held at Fort Taylor were usually individuals guilty of disloyalty, either suspected or demonstrated, economic malfeasance, usually in the form of running the blockade, or just being generally obnoxious to the U.S. troops who were trying to impose martial law. All of these offenses that we're talking about here really kind of shed light on how the Civil War, again, reached the United States' southernmost possessions. And even though it's not readily talked about in the historical record, Union authorities used Fort Taylor to demonstrate the power of the federal government. And this is where I think the state, I mean, there's kind of a hierarchy of state parks, or parks in general, public history sites. The National Park Service probably has the best interpretive program, even though there are some ways that we could improve that, like Chris talked about. But the state parks people usually don't talk a lot about. But I think if they did, then maybe the casual observer who's passing by might learn more about the experience of people who are actually held here and maybe spend a little bit less time looking at these. Because, I mean, once you get to this galley, I mean, you're really going to stop reading. And you're also not really going to think about what's going on in the cells. So I'm just going to give you a couple of examples now of the types of prisoners that were held at Fort Taylor and their experience. So we're looking at the inside of the cell here. I don't know if these are modern-day scribblings, but certainly if you got bored and you're staring at that door all day, if you're a prisoner, you might have started carving in the wall, and that would have been the view you would have gotten when you entered the fort. So the first documented offender that was held in Fort Taylor was recorded in July 1861, and he was a local Methodist minister who was held for the crime of inciting rebellion from the pulpit. So his offense was that he advocated that burning pine knots be inserted into the flesh of Unionists to convert them from their heresy. So that was enough to get Union authorities to decide that he was treasonous and throw him in there. U.S. authorities moving forward, they dealt with some blockade runners, obviously, but U.S. authorities on Key West determined that these were not adequate holding facilities for them. So the first indication for that came in early 1862 when the U.S. Marshal at Key West notified Secretary of State William Seward that no proper accommodations existed on the island for captives detained by naval officers and committed to his custody. Seward then suggested to Secretary of the Navy Gideon Wells that prisoners passing through Key West and confined at Fort Taylor should eventually be transferred by the steamer to Connecticut, Rhode Island, or New York, and ultimately confined in Fort Lafayette. I just think it's funny that given some of the discussions we've had about horrendous conditions in some of the camps, that's tight quarters. It's probably about the dimensions of a penitentiary cell at the time. But for that to be deemed inadequate is rather ironic, I think. But nonetheless, transfer was not always immediate. And so that tells us about Fort Taylor's function as a temporary holding facility that preceded prisoners' transfers to other locations. Or it also could afford U.S. officials a secure place to hold men awaiting court-martial. So, for example, on November 29, 1861, the Washington, D.C. National Republican reported that the U.S. steamship Connecticut had captured the British schooner Adelaide of Nassau, which was loaded with coffee, lead, swords, and, quote, the supercargo, Lieutenant Hardy, a relative of Tactics Hardy, who was an officer in the Confederate Army. So Hardy tried to kind of plead innocence. He says that property's, it's mine, and I'm taking it to Savannah, but please don't put me in prison. And the Union authorities, of course, aren't going to buy that. They detain him at Fort Taylor until he could be transferred to New York. In some cases, this kind of transfer system worked in reverse. So on June 2nd, 1862, the New York Times reported that 24 men from the engineering department under the command of General David Hunter at Port Royal, South Carolina, arrived at Key West on the schooner Isaac M. Holmes. So these men were sent to Fort Taylor for punishment. Their offense was that in South Carolina, they struck for higher wages and refused to work until their demands were met. So upon arrival at Key West, the offenders learned that they're going to be held at Fort Taylor, and every day a military guard would escort them out into town to perform their appointed labor for the day on the public works for punishment, not pay. In a similar vein, in 1863, after the draft riots had occurred in New York City, there were draft resistors who were sentenced to hard labor at Key West to complete Fort Taylor, because when the Civil War broke out, it was still an incomplete fort. So they were going to complete Fort Taylor and the island's two Martello towers. But the prisoners really didn't want to have any of it. They didn't want to see Fort Taylor. So they vowed en route to rule Key West. And upon arrival, what they did was they attacked a gentleman, abused a man's black servants, stoned his house, and threatened his wife. So Union authorities obviously didn't tolerate that. And for their, they called it their good behavior, they sentenced these men to 6 months imprisonment at hard labor at Fort Jefferson, which we mentioned before. Sometimes, like I mentioned, guard duty might seem like a sentence in and of itself. And that was the case for men of the 90th New York Volunteers, who on the 9th of March, 1863, the New York Tribune reported that those men of that regiment on duty at Fort Taylor had proved traitorous. Joseph Morgan, who was commanding the island at the time, he took the swords from men of that regiment who had been recreant to their duty and sentenced the offenders to Fort Taylor for confinement until U.S. authorities at Hilton Head summoned them for court-martial. Shortly after that, in June 1862, the fort held local secessionists. Their names were Winer Bethel and William Pinckney, and they were pretty much from the start. They're pro-secession. They're really pushing for the delegates from Key West to get Florida out of the Union, and they don't drop those sentiments as they continue to reside on the island. And so U.S. authorities held them in close confinement in Fort Taylor until they were sent to Fort Monroe. Almost immediately after the arrest of Bethel and Pinckney, U.S. authorities nabbed Mr. W.D. Cash, who on Key West was employed at the Wall & Company store, and his arrest was made on the accusation by a black drayman, whose name was Noah Lewis. And so Lewis reported that Cash had made treasonable utterances against the U.S. government, which included a wish at that time that every Union officer and soldier would die of yellow fever. That was kind of a timely wish in 1862 because there was a massive yellow fever epidemic. So that was enough to get you sent to Fort Taylor for sure. So they held Cash in Fort Taylor for about 2 weeks without a trial, and then Union authorities kept trying to get him to take an oath of allegiance. And she keeps saying, I'm not going to take the oath of allegiance until you make some concessions to me. I don't want to take a full oath. I just want to take a partial oath, and then I'll get out. So eventually, he did that, and he was released. Other offenses, just a couple more examples. Martial law violations. Like I mentioned before, there was a ban on liquor during the Civil War. And so people who were trying to operate grog shops were shut down and thrown in. Two blockade runners that were pretty prominent. Number one, James McKay, who was a Tampa resident. He was kind of an opportunist, to say the least. But he got detained in Fort Taylor for trying to run 600 pistols, 500,000 percussion caps, 600 dozen hats, 8 cases of shoes, and 400,000 cigars through the Confederate blockade. So he gets sent to Fort Taylor. Eventually, he's sent to Washington. He pleads his case. Eventually, Union authorities let him out, and then he goes and supports the Confederacy again. One other blockade runner was a man by the name of Alphonse Laurent, who was a resident of Havana trying to run the blockade, gets caught, in his opinion, deceptively by U.S. troops, is actually released. He goes back to Havana, and he kind of pleads protection from the British consulate. The British consulate lets him go back to Key West to try to plead his case, and when he shows up, Union authorities nab him and throw him in Fort Taylor, where he said he was treated roughly. So, the last account of prisoners held at Fort Taylor appeared in November of 1865. So there was a Confederate ship that was passing along the Florida coast with former Confederate soldiers. They were stopped by a U.S. ship, and to their surprise, they, one, learned that the war was over, and two were held in Fort Taylor. But these stories just don't make it into the interpretive program. As you can see, people are kind of drawn by the scenery. They're drawn by the appeal of the big guns. And as far as the interpretive program at Fort Taylor goes, the unit management plan in 1999 and 2008 said that its primary goal was to preserve cultural resources and to share the island's history with visitors. But it would be interesting to see when the new interpretive plan comes out in 2018 if any more is added about the Civil War era at Fort Taylor that deals with the prisoners on the island and really martial law itself, which is something that's pretty much overlooked. Thank you.
When my throat goes dry in the middle, it's not too awkward.
Is that working now? Can you guys hear me? Excellent. Well, first off, I want to say thank you to everyone. As I get to go last, I actually can say with complete sincerity, every paper was awesome and worth hearing. I'm the only one that gets to say that. The problem with going last is that I've had to rewrite my paper every panel, including this one. Now I'm wondering how I'm supposed to work in martial law POWs during Reconstruction, which we haven't even thought about speaking about, is all these people arrested in 1867, but we won't go there. So let me also thank the organizers for a wonderfully put on conference. You guys have done a wonderful job. And for the questions we've gotten, it's been amazing. And it's been great to have the gang back together again. If you want to know what I was going to say, go ahead and look on Dropbox and you can look at the original. I've modified my comments thanks to everything you've taught me. So first I want to say I'm here to talk today about nationalism and the POW Museum at Andersonville. And some of you may be familiar with my work on race and how it was erased at Andersonville, largely. As part of that process, I touched on nationalism just a little bit, and how it helped cover a racial stripe. But today I get to just focus on that nationalism, which I'm really excited about, because it's something that we overlook when we're looking at how POWs are used in the narratives that so many of you have spoken about this week. So I want to examine how the museum's focus on telling heroic narratives not only helps support a belief in American exceptionalism, but also that it's ahistorical. And it leads to some frankly racist and inaccurate portrayals of the past. And I think if you listen with me, you'll see that we're making a lot of progress on how POWs are interpreted, but there's still a long way to go in the public eye. So in many ways, the National POW Museum aims to create a sense of nationalism, a pride in being American. First, it does this in a few ways. First, it provides a master narrative of captivity, as Chris Bard called it, a narrative of captivity, where Americans have always suffered as POWs in every war without ever asking, is that suffering necessary? Suffering instead becomes evidence of patriotism, of masculinity, and of heroism. Second, it separates America's own treatment of POWs from the master narrative. It implies that Americans uniquely do not mistreat their prisoners. Instead, Americans are portrayed as distinct from other nations, as how we treat our prisoners. As, according to the museum, we treat them well. Now, of course, this is ironic, given the suffering at Andersonville, right outside the doors of the National POW Museum, and the reason the museum's there was, in fact, inflicted upon Americans by other Americans. And as we learned yesterday, of course, Vietnam, it was definitely not true that Americans always treated their prisoners of war very nicely. Thirdly, the museum whitewashes racial issues in American history, portraying a shared history that excludes racial tensions.
even though race and racism were fundamental to the creation of Andersonville and the actual National Historic Site. The museum narrative is the result of a series of compromises aimed at avoiding controversy. And this provides us a classic example of how public historians who make too large an effort to avoid controversy can lead to problematic historical narratives. Sometimes controversy is good. Now, I need to acknowledge, a lot of public historians are also working with the public. They have to keep their funding. They have to get tips if they're a tour guide. So when I criticize them, I do this with the utmost of love and the understanding that history is not the only thing that controls what narrative they tell. There's a lot about what a visitor is willing to hear. But to understand how nationalism played a role in the museum, you have to understand the legacy of the Civil War. And you have to understand that it's still being fought over when this museum was made in the 1990s. And it still is today, obviously. I think all the Civil War folks would agree, at least, on this, that it seems to be relevant in the news lately. From the beginning, those involved in the planning of the National POW Museum were conscious in their attempts to avoid controversy because they walked through a political minefield of memory, and they didn't want to lose funding or support or their designation as a National Historic Site. So afraid of angering anyone, the NPS censored itself on a variety of topics as they worked to create a museum in what Park Superintendent Fred Boyles, your Cub Scout leader, called the most controversial site in the National Park Service. Now, I'm not sure it's the most controversial, but it's controversial. And one way to do that was to focus on heroic stories that portrayed American service members in the best light. For instance, a planned discussion about POWs who collaborated with North Korea was removed. POWs like Earl Hess discussed that were less than heroic ended up having no place in this narrative. And accuracy was not always key, as is the case with what Angie was mentioning. And so instead, as Boyles would say and defends the deletion, it reflects the difficulty in presenting the complex issue of prisoners' code of conduct, particularly in Korea, where Americans were tortured for information and not as a result of any pressure from former POWs. Now, what he's referring to is that the American ex-POWs organization was doing the fundraising for this museum, and that's why I say it's not just history that determines what narrative you're saying when you're building a museum. You have a lot of stakeholders and constituencies you have to make happy. They were going to be unlikely to be keen to recount a narrative of the war that portrayed themselves in a negative light, understandably. As Brian Feltman pointed out, captured but not conquered is the sort of the term that was used in World War I. In the creation of this museum, it was not by arms alone, as the American ex-POWs organization came. A focus on resistance became crucial in the narrative that was created. And as James Quinn pointed out, POWs not being viewed as traitors is what ex-POWs really wanted. That was crucial to the sort of narrative that they were afraid of having be told instead, that they would be portrayed negatively. The combination of measures to avoid offending white Southerners because of the racial issues, which we're not going to talk about, while also satisfying POWs from more recent wars, created a lot of interpretive compromises. But nevertheless, it resulted in one of the most impressive museums that visitors cannot help but find moving. I don't know what percent come out crying, you'll have to tell us later. But it's a very moving museum, and if you're not moved at least a little bit to tears at some point in that museum, I'd be surprised. Often compared to the Holocaust Museum due to its experiential design. You actually experience becoming a prisoner of war, starting with captivity and being taken captive, and ending with the return home. The museum, though, was fundamentally different than the Holocaust Museum. Instead of never again, the message was POWs are heroes worthy of idolizing. Instead of emphasizing the tragedy that POWs have often experienced, or presenting the frequency of suffering as an example of the inhumanity which man is capable of, the museum offers a narrative of resistance and loyalty by American servicemen and women. And there was, again, a recurring focus on resistance without arms across all wars. The museum all but ignores POWs' experience were not as traumatic or did not try to escape. Escape is presented as an expected factor. There is definitely no mention of POWs who joined the other side. Indeed, one National Park Service regional spokesman remarked shortly after the museum opened that it was, quote, like a shrine to POWs. So the POW experience becomes only a heroic human struggle. There's no environmental impact. There's just none allowed. Because it's about men surviving over this inflicted suffering as a sign of their devotion. Now, this is hardly surprising that this is the narrative you get, given the role of former POWs in designing the museum. Just as early Andersonville captivity narratives or Confederate captivity narratives written after the Civil War presented a heroic, redemptive story, the National POW Museum found heroes also within captivity. Former POWs understandably wanted their own story to be one of heroic sacrifice, as their masculinity was at stake, and their own service was at stake. Indeed, one of the most common complaints after it was opened, according to Fred Boyles, was that former POWs from specific camps complained that their camp wasn't included, and they worried that they were being left out. They're looking for their own story to be told so that they can point to it and show that they were a hero. So a story that was critical to the United States was never going to pass muster. But this universalization of the past remains inherently problematic. By emphasizing prisoners' shared willingness to suffer, it allows visitors to skirt issues of responsibility. Indeed, the museum creates an expectation of suffering for POWs, because, according to the museum, prisoners have always suffered for their country. As Douglas Gardner, I think, mentioned, the narrative is that they suffered for their country. Abuse of POWs becomes an unavoidable part of the larger tragedy of war. Andersonville is not a crime of war, but a product of war. Regrettable, but inevitable. So the museum never really addresses the issue of who's responsible for the thousands of deaths and months of anguish that POWs went through. Strikingly, the single, poorly lit, and easily missed panel that discusses war crimes trials focuses on Nuremberg and fails to mention Henry Wirz, the commandant of Andersonville, who was executed after what was arguably one of the first war crimes trials and who had served right outside the door. In part, leaving Wirz off the exhibit is likely because the museum treats Confederates as American servicemen. This was likely part of Boyles' fear of angering neo-Confederates, but leads to an inevitable critique of the Confederacy. As Angelo might note, Confederate ex-POWs would be happy with the erasure of Wirz. Indeed, because the Confederacy are included as U.S. POWs. So far as I can tell, and I've looked a few times, in the main exhibit halls, the only POWs discussed that were not on the side of the United States military are Confederates. Loyalists captured during the American Revolution are not part of the American POW story. But Confederates at Johnson Island are. The focus on celebrating heroic American POWs created an atmosphere where anything that lifts the focus away from heroic prisoners and addresses villains or war crimes is unacceptable. In part, not only does this lead to there being no criticism of the Confederacy, but, as Benjamin Cloyd pointed out in his book on POW memory, the narrative presented by the National POW Museum corresponds to the ongoing desire of Americans to patriotically remember and admire the sacrifices of past soldiers, which fundamentally and unfortunately inhibits a candid assessment of the evils committed during the Civil War. Now, he could have added to that any other war, for that matter. He was focused on the Civil War, but the same can be said on how it treats other conflicts. So we lose those less-than-loyal POWs, and we lose Americans who don't treat prisoners well. As part of that celebration and avoiding of candid assessments, we get that America treated prisoners differently, and I want to go into that. So it's not just responsibility, it's how we do it, if you're American. There's no discussion of America's tangled history with holding POWs. America becomes the exception that proves the rule. They're the one group in the world that do not let POWs suffer. Now, this is ironic given, again, the museum's location, a site that is only historically significant because of the suffering of POWs. In a side hallway, easily missed by most visitors, is a single wall display devoted to POWs in the U.S. Now, this display is largely devoted to America's kind treatment of German and Japanese POWs during the war. And it presents America as always treating the prisoners better, even when they're foreigners. Not just when they're American, but when they're foreigners. There's no mention of Vietnam's Bell telephone hour or the long step. And this ahistorical narrative allows museum visitors to leave without any moral qualms or uneasiness about America's part in past, present, and future suffering of prisoners of war, or even war, which leads to the suffering of prisoners of war. And this comes with a racist and ahistorical part that we come to now. And Adam Rock, if you were here still, you will enjoy this and how racism is also present in the memory of the treatment of Japanese and German POWs as well as the reality. Instead of seeing difference for the public, the museum presents all POWs as being treated the same. Besides the photos of Germans and Japanese prisoners are three images, though, discussing Native American prisoners held by the United States military in the 1890s. Located outside of the main exhibit hall, alongside foreign POWs, the implications of this brief presentation are clear. Native Americans are not part of the American POW story, even though we know that they were in the War of 1812, part of that story, thanks to earlier this week. They're not Americans, though, according to the narrative. And their captivity by the American government was not part of the American POW experience. And if you're looking for an example of state power being expressed, Daniel, along racial lines, this is one for you to look at. You can see it in the case of how Native Americans are treated during the Civil War. Because instead of POWs, you have Native American criminality, is the understanding of Native American, which should be POWs. The largest mass execution in American history was Native American prisoners during the Civil War. In 1862, the United States hung 38 Native Americans captured during the Dakota War in Minnesota. This would be the perfect example of suffering of POWs. And this is something you should check out, Daniel, when you're looking for various groups being treated differently. Because at the same time, Confederates were being treated as POWs, even though they were committing treason as opposed to a member of a totally different sovereign state. And this captivity of Native Americans fits this universalized narrative of suffering better than Confederates do. Why are they lumped together with Germans and Japanese and not Confederate POWs, this other group of POWs who fought against the United States at the exact same time? In a museum devoted to, quote, to all Americans held as prisoners of war, the fact that they are excluded and clumped with non-Americans is a problem. As Joseph Miller mentioned, Native Americans and POWs aren't just the Civil War story. They're a story that goes throughout many of America's internal wars. Because in implying that they are not Americans, this is about race, I would argue. This is not just that only American service members count. Because indeed, the museum's main exhibit discusses British POWs escaping from Germany. This exclusion is not just about fighting against the United States. And this one's for Bao. In the main exhibit, recognizing the importance of mail, we actually find three letters from the Confederacy, or Confederates held as POWs in camps in the North, treating them as American POWs even as they fought against the United States. So intentionally or not, Native Americans are treated in a way that demonstrated how much race was ignored when the museum was designed. I'm also confident that this is about race because of how they're depicted. This small space seems to belong in the 1950s instead of the 21st century. The caption for an image of Geronimo informs visitors that although nominally a prisoner of war, Geronimo was treated as a kind of national celebrity. It ignores the fact that Geronimo was technically a POW when he died at the age of 79. It turns out being treated as a tourist attraction, where cities lobby to be the location that imprisons you, so as to attract visitors, is not the same as being a celebrity. It also, quotes Richard Pratt, a man who modern scholars have argued was a practitioner of genocide, as being kindly, and that, quoting him to say, the daily contact with our kindly people brought amazing results in transforming Indians into capable, civilized men. An awkward situation when you know anything about Richard Pratt, and if you want to know more about it, you can read up the rest of my paper, but I want to continue because I only have a few more minutes. A historical treatment of Native Americans would tarnish pro-American views of the past, where a United States is somehow exempt from a belief that all POWs suffer. This sense of American exceptionalism would similarly be blemished if the museum looked critically at Andersonville, the place it actually sits, where numerous other Civil War camps, both North and South, run by Americans. Not to mention the mistreatment and torture that Americans have done upon POWs during the Philippines, in Vietnam, and during the War on Terror. It's not just Native Americans who are forgotten from American history in this whitewashed history. African Americans are also. And again, if you want to know more about that, my article goes into that in Civil War history, so I won't bore you with it, as that's already out there. But it also, I will say that the museum's universalized narrative conceals the immediate causes that led to the creation of Andersonville. And now one of the key questions we've discussed here this week is, what is a POW? We started with that almost, of who gets to be considered a POW. And in fact, the first room of the museum is entitled, What is a POW? This key question. But there is no mention that disagreements over defining POWs was intimately tied to the founding of Andersonville. Andersonville existed precisely because of debates over who got to be a POW. A discussion of the Confederacy's refusal to treat black troops equally, causing the breakdown of prisoner exchanges, creating the need for Andersonville, it fits perfectly in this room. But two problems. First, the fact that an exchange cartel might have limited suffering is not relevant in a narrative that assumes suffering. It's a natural part of the prisoner of war experience, after all. Additionally, it would anger lost cause advocates who still somehow believe, I don't know why, Ulysses S. Grant ended the prisoner exchange months before he was even in command. He was a very impressive commander, you know, giving commands before he was in command. He was that. Everyone wonders who's the best general in the Civil War. It's got to be him now. This narrative that the United States is somehow exempt from mistreatment furthers the ability to overlook efforts to protect POWs today. There's nothing for the United States to do to better the condition of POWs because the United States doesn't mistreat them. There's no question of how could this happen? How do we keep it from happening again, which you would get at the United States Holocaust Museum. In the end, the National POW Museum fundamentally asks different questions. And I think that's partially because Holocaust victims who were influential in creating that museum saw themselves as victims and not necessarily as heroes. And so their goal was not to present themselves as heroes, but to prevent genocide from ever happening again. The focus on heroism in the National Holocaust Museum is instead on those who saved Jews and alleviated problems. How much different would the museum be if we looked at efforts to help prisoners of war instead of just on their suffering? While ducking controversy is easier, it surrenders an opportunity for critical debate and education about contemporary issues. We can't discuss the debates over the treatment of Guantanamo detainees, enhanced interrogation, or Abu Ghraib, all of which I think were mentioned at various points this weekend. These will remain missing from the exhibits so long as we are committed to this narrative in which Americans resist heroically while treating their own prisoners nicely. Indeed, we avoid the moral legacies of Andersonville as well. Were it not for slavery, there would be no Civil War. Were it not for race, there would be no Andersonville. To have to face the reality that Andersonville and the dead there died in a war that had a cause, that the survivors suffered for a reason, forces white Southerners and all Southerners to address unsettling questions regarding race and responsibility and the inhumanity man is capable of. Hopefully, and they've begun this. Unfortunately, in recent years, this has begun to change. Chris Barr sort of led this charge, which is why I'm so glad that he's here today. They've worked to correct many of these interpretive problems. Now, unfortunately, Chris went and got a job at a different park. Thanks a lot for ruining that. But my hope is that he has left behind, and I think he has, in looking at how much progress continues to be made, that they will continue this work that Chris talked about to incorporate POWs in a more accurate way, in a more inclusive way that includes not only white Union and Confederate prisoners, but Native American prisoners, African Americans, and prisoner of war in other conflicts, as well as prisoners of war held by the United States. And that this new generation of Rangers currently at the museum will do a better job of fulfilling its mission of telling the story of all POWs in American history. And hopefully all of your guys' work, as it gets published in the a volume at the end that will eventually be created, at least from some of the papers I hope to see, we'll get out to those Rangers, and we'll get out to those museums and be incorporated when it's redesigned. Thank you.
Well, thank you, everybody, and especially the panelists. We still have some time for questions here. So I know that some of you might have to leave already. I realize that. But three wonderful papers, and yes, sir.
Well, yeah, it is, and like I said, this is a museum that I find incredibly moving, incredibly impressive, and really does capture in many ways aspects of the prisoner of war experience very well. But I think one of the reasons we ended up with this museum that we often ignore is not so much the POWs themselves that were living when it was created, but an effort that sort of starts in the 1970s to change the meaning of the site to sort of avoid controversy around the lost cause by saying, oh, we're going to preserve the site. You know, Jimmy Carter is involved in this process. Jimmy Carter and his sort of this group of boosters wanting to bring money to the community, that's his local community, said, we're gonna do this, but don't worry, we're not gonna forget Elmira, and we're not gonna forget others. We're gonna do all POWs, and that's how the mission gets created. And this is going on at the exact same time as you have a POW crisis because you have POWs in Vietnam. And literally on the newspaper from the local paper, if you look, it's amazing. On one column, it will say, you know, congressman here to see about making a park. And right next to it, it'll be like another airman captured. And so in many ways, this sort of was the fact that you had a POW crisis and they weren't sure what to do with it. At the same time as you had the issue of the lost cause and how do you deal with preserving the site without pissing off lost causes was, all right, we'll just combine all POWs. And it's not till the 90s that mission actually gets even considered. And you have to give Fred Boyles a lot of credit, because before him, the museum didn't even address other parks. It was like a one-room shack that had like five artifacts. I think there's a really big history about how that museum gets created that involves controversy. Without that controversy, you don't get it. I mean, I'm a cynic professionally. I'm an optimist personally, but
no, he's not. Can I actually, along those lines? So when I was still down there, I did a tour one time for a group of exchange students who were at Georgia Southern, and I was telling somebody about that earlier. But they were all students from they'd all been, you know, child refugees from Bosnia in the Civil War there, and they were literally visiting Andersonville to kind of see, okay, how do you guys talk about this without like killing each other talking about it? And so kind of what you were getting at, I mean, like some other countries are actually, or at least people from other countries are looking at the National POW Museum in that line. And that was not a tour I was expecting to give that day. And it was, I mean, it's still like I get weepy thinking about those kids. But
Al?
Still gonna have prisoners.
Kickoff's in an hour. I'll see you guys later.
Still gonna have prisoners, right?
So, you know, to be honest with you, I mean, I think that's, I don't know. Like, I really don't. How should we do it?
Angie, you gotta answer that one. Yeah. I ain't touching it.
We'll send them to Key West? I mean, yeah. I don't know. No, I mean, I think that it's one of those things. So kind of harkening back to what Paul Springer was talking about. I mean, I think at some point, I mean, how, I don't think we can really even address how will we talk about this until we're willing to talk about this. I mean, like I kind of jokingly said to my boss one time when I was down there that that if I could redesign the museum, I would take the entire back wall off and like put the photo of that he showed of the prisoner in the hood from Abu Ghraib. And my boss said, "You're not doing that, and you're not ever going to tell anyone that you even suggested that I want to work there." And he's not there anymore either. So I can tell you that I mean, I wasn't being serious, but it was until we're even willing to talk about that without, you know, somebody getting angry and flying off at the handle. I don't think we can even start to answer that question yet.
One thought that I had, and this doesn't come from the project on Key West, but it comes from my book research, is that there's a parallel between the Civil War and the War on Terror, and that they're not declared wars. And so when I was doing the research for my book project, I was basically looking at how the civilian and military system of punishment overlapped. And there was a big discussion during the Civil War at points about, you know, where do you try somebody? Do you send them to a court-martial? Do you send them to a military tribunal? Or do you send them to civilian courts? And that's been a parallel discussion that's come up in Guantanamo Bay. I mean, so maybe one of the answers down the road is thinking systemically. Like, how do you classify things? But other than that, that's people down the road, I guess, will figure that out.
Oh, what do I think? I don't think you're going to... I think you're still going to have prisoners there. I'm a cynic. I don't know that it will be an issue there so much as how we remember it. I don't think people are going to be visiting Guantanamo Bay. It'll probably still be a military base. Or it'll be underwater, depending on how global warming goes. I think the better question is how will it be remembered? And I think it's going to be remembered very badly. It is not going to bode well, at least internationally, how it will be remembered domestically. But you have a situation where you have individuals who are not POWs, we refuse to call them POWs, who are not being tried, who have been held for, what year are we at? 16 years are we at now? I've lost track. And never been able to justify it. So, not to get on my horse, but I don't think it's going to bode well for the United States in our history to try to justify that. I don't foresee it being written nicely.
Lorian?
Can I just throw in a comment that I was thinking about that relates to what Angela said? But to me, this goes back to how POWs are integrated into larger narratives. Because I think what we're seeing here is that POWs always are a pivotal turning point on some of the most complex, difficult issues to work out in warfare. And I think maybe if we understand that, that will help us understand how to present that publicly, that we can't get away from controversy with POWs because they always intersect with controversy.
Yeah, if I could follow on that. One thing you're going to see, I think, also, especially with the war on terror, is what does victory look like? Well, victory would look like we don't have prisoners anymore, right? I mean, that's sort of a fundamental question that's still unanswered about the war on terror. When you're talking about prisoners of war intersecting with bigger questions of the war, I think that's another question that intersects is what is victory? Because that's when you get to stop having Guantanamo. And that's never been defined, as far as I can tell, when the war on terror ends.
Mm-hmm. And to try to group them in with unfortunate victims.
Angela gets the honor of the last question.
Sweet.
Yes.
Well, I wanted to say that, Angela said it way better. I think it was really an honor to listen to you guys today, to spend time with you guys, all the presenters, the audience. I think it was a successful 2 days. We're looking forward to more work on prisoners of war, more work on interpreting prisoner of war stories. And again, thank you for the Filson for hosting us, and especially Leanne for all the work and her staff, and also feeding us and making this a really enjoyable 2 days. So thank you very much. Enjoy your rest of the weekend. We hope to hear and see you guys soon in other venues and in other opportunities. Thank you.
Wanted to make sure that we give a big hand to the Filson staff, who Scott Scarborough, who ran all the audio, and Jamie Evans, Laura Wiley, Julie Skosky, who made all the food appear and disappear, and who did a whole lot of other work to make this possible. And I would also like to give a big hand to our audience, the Filson Historical Society members, whose love of history makes all of this possible. Thank you very much.
It doesn't work?
Yep. Right. Thank you.